Okay, great. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming, and also thank you for inviting me to this wonderful conference. The weather is amazing, and the town is beautiful, and food was just fantastic in this country. And it's so nice to be here, and I'm very grateful to the organizers of this conference, and especially Sophia for her hospitality and also translating my paper from English to Italian. I'm sorry that I have to give this talk in English. Unfortunately, I don't speak Italian, but I will try to speak slowly. And if anything is unclear, please let me know in the question time. So the topic of this paper is the problem of evil. The problem of evil is concerned with the existence of God and its compatibility with the existence of evil in this world. So how come there are wars and murders and, you know, a lot of horrible events in this world if God created this world? So God is meant to be all-loving, all-powerful, and all-knowing. So how could there be evil in this world? Now, arguably, this is the greatest challenge for atheists. So many people think that this is the best argument against theism. And there have been a lot of books and papers written on this topic. So according to a certain researcher, more than 3,600 articles and books have been written on the problem of evil since 1960 alone. And this data are a little bit old, about 15 years old. So I'm sure that there have been even more papers since then. Now, there are a lot of different versions of the problem of evil. So, for example, there is the logical problem of evil, which says that the existence of God is logically incompatible with the existence of evil. So it's just a matter of logical inconsistency is the question. So the existence of God is logically inconsistent with the existence of evil. There is also the evidential problem of evil, which is slightly more modest than the logical problem. So this problem says that the existence of evil is not necessarily logically inconsistent with the existence of God, but nevertheless, it is good evidence against the existence of God. And also there is the problem of horrendous evil, which is introduced by Marilyn Adams. And Adams focuses on intense pain and suffering of specific individuals. So sometimes when people go through intense, you know, really horrific pain and suffering, you might wonder whether these people's lives are worth living. So you might think that actually they're so intense and so bad that it might not be worth living this kind of life. And that kind of personal, emotional problem is arguably good evidence against the existence of God. There is also the problem of natural evil. So philosophers tend to focus on the problem of moral evil. So they tend to focus on wars and murders and all sorts of crimes that are committed by people who are moral agents. But actually, there is natural evil as well. So if you look at nature, there are a lot of horrible natural disasters that could kill a lot of people. And you might wonder, how could there be God if there are so many horrible natural disasters in this world? But anyway, there are a lot of different versions of the problem of evil, and they are all targeted against theists because they are arguments against theism. And also there are a lot of theistic responses to the problem of evil. So some theists appeal to free will. So they say that, you know, because God had to create free humans, and humans sometimes do morally wrong things, even though they sometimes do morally good things as well. But because of the consequence of their free will, there is evil in this world. And some other people appeal to soul-making. So John Hick says that evil is necessary for our spiritual growth. So evil is not necessarily a positive thing. It's not a positive thing all the time, but nevertheless, in order for us to mature our souls, we have to experience evil. Skeptical theists claim that because our knowledge is so limited compared with God's knowledge of morality and the world and so on, that we just cannot comprehend why there has to be evil. But actually, you know, there must be a reason why God has to allow evil. But we just cannot see it because our knowledge is so limited. Anyway, there are a lot of responses to the problem of evil as well. So they try to show that the existence of God and the existence of evil are compatible. Now, in this paper, I want to introduce a new form of the problem of evil, which I call the problem of systemic evil. And this problem focuses on natural selection. So it is a version of the problem of natural evil. Now, nature is governed by natural selection, which involves competition for survival. So according to the theory of evolution, nature is governed by random mutation and natural selection. But natural selection involves pain and suffering of billions of animals over many, many years. And uncountably, many organisms have competed and struggled for survival. And in this cruel blind system, the weaker are eliminated, and even the survivors will eventually die, often painfully and miserably. And Charles Darwin was quite puzzled by this problem. So he wondered why there has to be natural selection, which is such a horrible thing to have. And he introduces several specific examples of natural evil caused by natural selection. And here is his example on the slide. So there are a certain parasitic wasps that deposit eggs in caterpillars while the caterpillars are still alive. So they put eggs in the bodies of the caterpillars. And then these hatchlings, the babies of the wasps, when they hatch, they eat the live bodies of the caterpillars. And it looks like a really horrible thing for the caterpillars. And Darwin was quite puzzled by the existence of these insects. And here is a quote from Darwin. "With respect to the theological view of the question, this is always painful to me. I am bewildered. I had no intention to write atheistically, but I own that I cannot see as plainly as others do, and as I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seem to be too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that the beneficent and omnipotent God would have designatedly created the parasitic wasps with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice." So he was simply puzzled how an all-powerful, all-loving God create these insects. And he also said about his book, "What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering law and horribly cruel works of nature." And you know, it seems to me that nature is like a small cage in which many animals are placed together so that they desperately fight and kill each other for limited resources until a handful survive. So nature is as if this little cage where you put a lot of animals like cats and dogs and mice and insects and so on, and only a small amount of food and small amount of other resources. And basically you let them fight each other until some of them survive. So it's a really horrible thing to have, it seems to me. And Darwin wrote his book on the theory of evolution because he was influenced by Thomas Malthus's book on human population. So in that book, Malthus says that human population doesn't grow exponentially because we have limited resources, natural resources. So when there are too many people, then people start, try to survive within the limited natural resources. So there is an inevitable competition of people. So weaker people actually die out. So that's why the human population doesn't grow after a certain point, given the limited natural resources. And Darwin derived the idea of evolution from Malthus's work. So here are some further comments on this problem by philosophers. So Holmes Rolston III says, though there is no sin in amoral nature, there is quite a list of candidate evils from which nature might need to be redeemed. Predation, parasitism, selfishness, randomness, blindness, disaster, indifference, waste, struggle, suffering, death. So there are a lot of really, really horrible things that we wouldn't want to have in nature. Here's Richard Dawkins. Dawkins is, as you might know, an atheist scientist. And he says, natural selection is out there, and it is a very unpleasant process. Nature is red in tooth and claw. But I don't want to live in that kind of world. I want to change the world in which I live in such a way that natural selection no longer applies. So I think his claim that he wouldn't want to live in a world where natural selection is true is really illuminating, because we can imagine a political system that is based on natural selection, and that would be a horrible society. If you are sick or if you are handicapped, then you cannot survive. And only selfish people who are physically strong can survive, because only they can acquire food and other natural resources. But that kind of society is really horrible, and no one wouldn't want to live in that kind of society. But actually, nature seems to be like that. So it's quite analogous to this kind of horrible society. And you might think that actually, even if that's true, at least our lives are not that bad. We don't need to constantly kill each other to survive in our modern society. But even if we are free from a cruel survival game of beasts, billions of other sentient animals have to live and will live in such conditions, and our human existence depends on it. So there are, even if humans are free from this kind of survival game, there are billions of animals that have to go through these horrible pain and suffering because of natural selection. And also our existence depends on their pain and suffering. So we simply cannot ignore this kind of problem. And moreover, from a large historical point of view, humans are products of a long evolutionary process. And there are a lot of philosophers who discuss the problem of animal pain. So how could there be animal pain given the existence of God? So Quentin Smith, Paul Draper, Trent Doherty, Michael Murray, Christopher Southgate, and so on, they have addressed the problem of animal pain. But what I'm suggesting here is slightly different from their main focus, because I'm interested in the problem of systemic evil in nature. So I'm focusing on the system of natural selection, rather than specific instances of pain and suffering. So the problem of evil standardly focuses on specific events that are considered evil, such as the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide, the Boxing Day tsunami in Southeast Asia, and so on, or specific types of events, like wars, murders, rapes, earthquakes, floods, animal pain and suffering, and so on. But what I'm interested in here is the whole system of natural selection. The problem of systemic evil focuses on the entire biological system on which nature is based. And this problem seems to me to be more forceful and fundamental than other forms of the problem of evil. Okay, let us set aside the problem of systemic evil for the moment, and let's talk about something else, which is existential optimism. Existential optimism is the claim that the world is overall a good place and that we should be grateful for our existence in it. So the idea is that, you know, there are some bad things in this world, but overall the world is great and we should be grateful and thankful to be alive in this good world. Nearly all theists agree that overall this is a good world. Leibniz said that this is the very best possible world because this world was created by the very best possible being, namely God. Many people reject Leibniz's claim. Many people think that this world is not completely perfect, but nevertheless, most people, especially most theists, think that this world is a very good world, even though it might not be perfect. So here are some theistic philosophers' claims about existential optimism. So they all affirm existential optimism. So Tom Morris says that we have a duty to worship God and be thankful for his benefits. So God created this world and our existence as well, so we should be grateful for his benefits. Robert Adams says, people who worship God do not normally praise him for his moral rectitude and good judgment in creating us. They thank God for their existence as for an undeserved personal favor. And Swinburne also says, worship is obligatory. It is the proper response of respect by man to his creator. So these theistic philosophers, they all agree that we should be thankful to God and we should worship God because God created this world and us as well. And we should be happy to be alive and we should be grateful to God. Now, what do atheists say about existential optimism? So there's a caricatured view of atheists. So people tend to think that atheists are very pessimistic, nihilistic, negative people who are not necessarily happy about their own existence. So for example, David Benatar, he's an atheist and nihilist, and he says that our existence is bad, and he says that it's always bad to be alive. So here's a quote from Benatar's book. He says, although the good things in one's life make it go better than it otherwise would have gone, one could not have been deprived by their absence if one had not existed. Those who never exist cannot be deprived. However, by coming into existence, one does suffer quite serious harms that could not have befallen befallen one had one not come into existence. So he thinks that existence is always a bad thing and it's better not to exist. But he's an extreme form of nihilist. And actually, most atheists reject this kind of nihilism. And in fact, many of them affirm existential optimism. So many, if not most, atheists think that we have good reason to think that the world is generally good and that we should be happy and grateful that we live in it. So here are some quotes. So again, this is Richard Dawkins, who is quite a passionate atheist, but he affirms existential optimism. So here's a quote from his book. When I lie on my back and look up at the Milky Way, or when I look at the Grand Canyon, I'm overwhelmingly filled with a sense of almost worship. It's a feeling of sort of an abstract gratitude that I'm alive to appreciate these wonders. When I look down a microscope, it's the same feeling. I'm grateful to be alive to appreciate these wonders. And actually, this is not the quote from his book, but from his one of his lectures. So he expresses existential optimism, even though he's an atheist. He also says, we have cause to give thanks for our highly improbable existence and the law-like evolutionary processes that gave rise to it. Such gratitude is not owed to or to be directed towards anything, anyone or anything. So he doesn't think that there is God, so he says that his gratitude is quite abstract. He's not directing his gratitude to someone or to something. But nevertheless, he says that we should be thankful to be alive and thankful to be able to appreciate the beauty of nature, especially given that our existence is highly improbable. Here's another atheist. Greta Christina, who says, I have a strong awareness of having good things in my life that I didn't earn, including, most importantly, my very existence. And it feels wrong to not express this awareness in some way. I don't like treating my good fortune as if it is just my due. I think gratitude is a good thing. So again, even though she endorses atheism, she says that we should be grateful for our existence. And actually, it's wrong not to express this kind of gratitude. Now, let's go back to the existential problem, the problem of systemic evil. And let's combine it with existential optimism. So now I want to develop what I call the existential problem of systemic evil. And I claim that this problem applies to both theists and atheists. So the problem of systemic evil for theists was this. So it raises the following question. Why does God create such a violent, cruel, and unfair biological system if his nature is such that he's powerful enough and benevolent enough to avoid it? And now we modify this problem slightly so that it applies to both theists and atheists. So here is what I call the existential problem of systemic evil. Why should we think that the world is overall good and that we should be happy and grateful to be alive in it if our existence depends fundamentally on a violent, cruel, and unfair biological system which guarantees pain and suffering of uncountably many sentient animals? So both theists and at least many, many atheists agree that we should be grateful for our existence and we should be happy to be alive and the world is overall great. But how can we say that if our existence depends on this system, the biological system, which seems to be evil? The existential problem does not mention God. It is based on the conflict between systemic evil and existential optimism. That's why it applies to both atheists and theists. The existential problem raises a challenge not only for theists, but also for atheists, as I said, who hold existential optimism. So as long as atheists affirm existential optimism, this problem applies. The core of the existential problem is the conflict between the scientific fact that our existence depends fundamentally on a violent, cruel, and unfair biological system which guarantees pain and suffering for many people and many other sentient animals. And also existential optimism, according to which the world is overall a good place and we should be grateful for our existence in it. Now, there is a philosophical paradox called the apology paradox, which was introduced by Jana Thompson. And you might think that this paradox is very similar to what I call the existential problem of systemic evil. So let's compare this paradox with the existential problem. So here is the paradox. So there are a lot of historical injustices, especially global historical injustices. So for example, World War II, or the Holocaust, or slavery, and so on. So they are horrible historical events. Suppose that your existence depends on these historical events. So for example, suppose that your grandparents wouldn't have met if there hadn't been the Holocaust. So that means that your existence is dependent on the historical injustice, the Holocaust. But at the same time, you want to say that you are happy to be alive. It's a great thing that you are alive. But how can we consistently hold these two claims? How can we say that the Holocaust shouldn't have taken place, but at the same time, I'm happy to be alive? When there is an arrow from the Holocaust to your existence. So your existence depends on the Holocaust. And this paradox is called the apology paradox because Thompson focuses on politicians' apology concerning historical injustices. So sometimes politicians apologize for horrible events that were caused by their countries. But how could they sincerely apologize for these events if they are happy to be alive, and if their existence depends on these events? And you might think that this is a little bit analogous to the existential problem of systemic evil, because in the existential problem of systemic evil, we say that we are happy to be alive, so we affirm existential optimism, but at the same time, our existence depends on natural selection, which seems to be a horrible biological system, which involves a lot of pain and suffering of sentient animals. But I claim that the existential problem is more fundamental and more forceful than the apology paradox. So first of all, the existential problem focuses on the entire biological system rather than specific historical events. And also, it focuses on a nomologically necessary link rather than a causally sufficient link. So in the case of the apology paradox, this arrow is only causally necessary or causally sufficient. But in the case of the systemic problem, we are considering a nomologically necessary link between our existence and the biological system. So in that sense, it seems to me to be more fundamental than the apology paradox. Also, the existential problem focuses on the biological system for which humans are not responsible, rather than historical injustices for which they are responsible. So you might think that, you know, World War II and the Holocaust and so on, they are results of human free will. So humans are responsible. But in the case of natural selection, we are not really responsible. We are not responsible for the existence of natural selection itself. Also, the existential problem focuses on the existence of the world and humanity as a whole. So we are not talking about specific individuals, specific victims of historical injustices, but we are talking about the humanity as a whole. So in this sense, the existential problem seems to be more fundamental and more forceful, and the scope is much wider than the apology paradox. So here is Thompson's solution to the apology paradox. She says, we can consistently say that we are glad to be alive while regretting or apologizing for the fact that the historical injustice took place, because it is coherent to wish that our existence had been realized through some other causal link. So let me explain this in terms of possible worlds. The apology paradox is based on the following assumption. If the Holocaust had not taken place, then we would not have existed. But this claim is not. This claim doesn't entail the following claim. There is no possible world in which the Holocaust did not take place and we exist. Instead, the first thesis entails the following. In the closest possible world to the actual world in which the Holocaust did not take place, we do not exist. And this is compatible with the following. There is a possible world in which the Holocaust did not take place and we exist. So this is a little bit technical, but the basic idea is that there is a possible scenario in which the Holocaust did not take place, but we exist. And Thompson says that what we express when we apologize or when we regret about historical events is that we hope, we wish that that kind of world was actual. So what we do when we wish that the Holocaust had not taken place while holding existential optimism is to express our preference for a world described in full rather than the actual world. However, Thompson's solution does not apply to the existential problem of systemic evil. So my claim is that even if Thompson's solution is successful in undermining the apology paradox, you cannot apply the same reasoning to the existential problem of systemic evil. The existential problem of systemic evil is based on the following assumption. If natural selection had not governed nature, then we would not have existed. And this does not entail the following. There is no possible world in which natural selection does not govern nature, and we exist. Instead, this entails the following. In the closest possible world to the actual world in which natural selection does not govern nature, we do not exist. And this is compatible with the following claim. There is a possible world in which natural selection does not govern nature and we exist. But the world described in four is very different from the actual world because the laws of nature in such a world are different from those that apply to the actual world. So if we say that, you know, we wish that natural selection wasn't governing our nature, then we would be imagining a possible situation, a possible world that is radically different from our actual situation or actual world. Because in such a situation, the laws of nature are radically different. And wishing that the laws of nature were different so radically means that existential optimism is false. Because existential optimism says that the world is generally good and we should be happy and grateful to be alive in it. But if we wish that natural selection hadn't taken place or hadn't governed nature, then that means that we are wishing, basically we are saying that we are not happy with this world where the laws of nature involve natural selection. So here's a simpler way of presenting this point. So this diagram represents existential optimism, which says that, you know, there are some negative things in this world, but overall the world is good. So that's why the yellow part is larger than the black part, which represents negative things. Now, the existential problem of evil seems to suggest that actually our existence depends on something really fundamentally horrible, which is natural selection. So actually the previous diagram, this is not the correct representation of our world. actually our existence involves billions of suffering of billions of sentient animals. So actually, overall, the picture is very dark, like this. So that's the existential problem of systemic evil. And the positive things, such as our existence in this world, seems to be dependent on these negative things. So we can be alive because there are billions of other animals that have to suffer for our existence. The problem of evil, or more precisely, the problem of systemic evil, is no longer a problem exclusively for theists. And that's because, again, the existential problem of systemic evil doesn't involve God. It's just it's concerned with the compatibility between the existence of systemic evil and people's affirmation of existential optimism. So it's not an argument against the existence of God. So it applies to atheists as well as theists. And now, what I claim here, what I want to argue here, is that theists are significantly better situated to address the problem than atheists are. So again, many atheists think that the problem of evil is a knockdown objection to theism. But what I'm claiming here is that actually when it comes to the problem of systemic evil, theists are more advantaged than atheists. So atheists commonly think that the material universe is all there is, so the range of their ontology is quite limited. So most atheists are naturalists, so they don't think that there is supernatural reality. So they don't think that there is God, they don't think there is the afterlife, and so on. So their ontology is limited to this universe. So for atheists or naturalists, this physical universe, the material universe, is all there is. So that means that their ontology is represented in this picture, which is mostly dark. So there is some positive part, which is in yellow, but largely the whole world is pretty bad. However, theists commonly think that the material universe is not all there is. There are other supernatural things, such as God, which is a transcendental being that exists beyond the material universe, or the afterlife, which is our existence beyond our physical bodies. So the range of ontology is significantly and possibly infinitely wider than that of atheists. So theists believe that the material universe is not all there is, and there is significantly larger part of reality, which seem to be quite positive. So a diagram that theists have seemed to be this. So in this world, there are some positive things. So the small yellow rectangle represents our existence in this material universe, which seems to be pretty good. But at the same time, within the material universe, there are a lot of awful things like pain and suffering of sentient animals, which are represented in the black rectangles. But overall, the whole picture seems to be positive because there are a lot of great things beyond the physical world, which is represented by the large yellow part of this diagram. Theists are significantly better situated than atheists with respect to the existential problem of systemic evil. Theists have significantly greater and possibly infinitely greater resources than atheists. So in order to address the existential problem of systemic evil, atheists have to appeal to something within the physical universe because they think that the physical universe is all there is. But atheists can appeal to many other things beyond the physical universe, such as God, heaven, afterlife and so on. And they could also appeal to soul-making, or God's perfection, God's defeat of evil, or God's intimacy with us, and so on. So there are a lot of resources, theological or supernatural resources for theists, which atheists don't have. So here's the conclusion of my overall argument. So first, the problem of systemic evil is stronger than the traditional problem of evil. So it focuses on the whole system of natural selection rather than specific events, specific evil events, or specific types of evil events. And both theists and atheists typically endorse existential optimism. So as I said earlier, atheists are not necessarily pessimistic, nihilistic people. Most of them seem to me to endorse existential optimism, as much as theists do. The existential problem of systemic evil, which incorporates existential optimism, can be directed against not only theists, but also atheists. So again, the existential problem of systemic evil is not an argument against the existence of God. It's an argument concerning existential optimism and its compatibility with the existence of natural selection, which involves a lot of pain and suffering. And as far as the existential problem of systemic evil is concerned, atheists are significantly disadvantaged because their resources are limited to the physical universe, while atheists have a lot of other resources. They can appeal to all sorts of things beyond the physical universe. So in this sense, the existential problems of systemic evil is a stronger objection to atheism than theism. So therefore, it is no exaggeration to say that the existential problem of systemic evil is primarily a problem of evil for atheists. Thank you.
Thank you to Professor Nagasawa for a very interesting speech, talk. I apologize for my voice, but this morning I completely lost my voice. No, probably I got a cold, so sorry, I tried to speak clearly. exactly. Use my hand, I'm Italian, so you can use my hand. I really would like to thank Professor Nagasawa for coming and for his interesting talk that I'm sure gave many stimulation, many materials for the next discussion. For me, it was quite hard trying to reply to the paper. Because from one hand, I agree with Nagasawa thesis. In fact, according to Professor Nagasawa, atheists cannot endorse existential optimism and at the same time affirm that nature is based on the evil process of natural selection. The problem is, how can the world be in general a good place to live if it and our existence in it has its roots in a cruel, violent, an unfair biological system? As I said at the beginning, I agree with Nagasawa's thesis. If atheists endorse the existential optimism, they cannot contend that the biological system is evil. Otherwise, they fall into a sort of inconsistent position. On the other hand, I think there is a loophole, a strategy, a way to respond to the existential problem of systemic evil from an atheist point of view. So therefore, the aim of my paper or my speech is twofold. In the first part, I try to show that atheism has the resources to respond to the problem of systemic evil. While in the second part, I'll discuss two theistic solutions to this problem, the first provided by John Hick theodicy and the second by process theodicies, that are the two approaches, the two theodicies that we have met in the previous meeting. So let's start with part one and with my direct reply to Professor Nagasawa. So a sort of atheistic response to the existential problem of systemic evil. According to Nagasawa's argument, there are two basic points, and his argument is sound only if we hold both. First, the existential optimism, according to which the overall actual world is a good place, and we should be grateful for living in it. Second point, the systemic evil that is rooted in the very structure of nature. According to this perspective, the fundamental constitution of the biological system is evil. Now, what I suggest to do is to deny the second point. Atheists are not obliged to maintain this point, and once it is denied, the inconsistency in the existential problem of systemic evil is resolved. So I propose to deny the systemic evil, the second point. So the idea that systemic evil is rooted in the very structure of nature. The core of my argument lies in the distinction between necessity and contingency. As Nagasawa seems to contend, natural selection, with its cruelty and violence, is an evil embedded in the inner structure of the world. This means that the evil of natural selection is a fundamental component of the biological system, or in other words, that is necessary. There would not have been the actual biological system without the selective process of nature. So the process is necessary and fixed like a law. All beings in the world are subject to it. There is no way to escape from natural selection. Hence, we can define the natural selection as a sort of necessary systemic process that governs nature. At this point, I would like briefly to touch on the notion of necessity employed in my argument because it's quite important. The term necessary in this argument, in this context, doesn't mean that the principle of natural selection must be true for every possible logical world. It means that given the ontological structure of this world, the principle of natural selection is mutable and permanent. In fact, as far as we rationally and scientifically know, the only way nature has to evolve from simple to more complex form of life is natural selection. Necessary in this context doesn't mean universal or valid in any logically possible world. Necessary means it cannot be otherwise from an ontological standpoint, given the structure and the basic condition of our cosmos. Now, a theist, at this point, can rightly argue that the structure of the world could have been very different. In fact, theism contends the ontologically contingency of this universe, namely the fact that since this world, this cosmos, has been the consequence, the fact of a free divine choice, we could have lived in a very different and similar world and environment too. So, for theism, this world and all beings are ontologically contingent, namely, they could have been different from what they actually are. From a theistic point of view, natural selection is not a necessary feature of the world. In every moment, God could intervene in modifying the inner configuration of the world, of the cosmos, changing its laws. So, the basic organization, the basic configuration, constitution of the world is ontologically contingent. It can be modified at any time. Now, in this discussion, I'm not interested in questioning whether deism can successfully defend its position and what is the reason why God doesn't intervene in the world to, for example, stop some evils, or why God doesn't change the structure or the world. What is important here is to underline the ontological contingency of the basic structure of the world from a theistic point of view. Now, my question is, can atheism do the same thing? According to atheism, it is impossible to modify the inner structure of the world. This is given, is a matter of fact. Therefore, it seems useless and futile to query or complain for the process of natural selection and its cruelty and unfairness, just because there is nobody to blame for or to complain with. The world has not been created by a personal moral agent like God, nor it has been specifically designed as an environment for human beings, but it's a brute fact. If the world is a matter of fact and is the only existing reality from an ontological point of view, if it doesn't depend on any divine choice but is the resulting effect of natural processes, it follows that natural selection is a fixed, necessary process, unchangeable. Now, the very concept of evil entails the possibility of good. When we say that an aspect of the world, or the world as a whole, is evil, we mean that it could have been ontologically different and better. This is exactly what a theist does. She asks why God created the world like this. If he had the possibility and the ability to give rise to a much better one. Instead, an atheist accepts the world as it is. She doesn't consider its basic structure ontologically contingent, but necessary in the meaning of ontologically unalterable, not logically necessary. For example, a mathematical law or physical law is not evil, nor God, is not fair or unfair. At best, it can be right or wrong in the sense of whether it fits a process or an event. Hence, something that is ontologically necessary and unalterable cannot be judged as evil or God or unfair just because it is as it is. So, given that, first, the notion of evil implies contingency, namely possibility that the situation deemed evil could ontologically, not only logically, have been different and better. Second point, given that atheism affirms that the fundamental structure of the world is fixed and unvarying, then, from an atheistic point of view, the basic configuration of the world is not evil or good. It's just the world in which we live. Atheism doesn't possess an ontology able to found an axiological judgment on the fundamental organization of the world. So, according to Hirt, the essential structure of the world is a necessary, non-contingent feature, and what cannot be otherwise cannot be considered an evil nor a good. My question is, how can atheists judge the biological system as evil if it is a given, unavoidable fact? It would be like complaining for the fact that all beings in the world are condemned to die. We can regret for the unfortunate circumstances that have caused the death of a young man, of a little child, but we cannot regret for the very fact that we are limited creatures and that who will die sooner or later. It is an unavoidable aspect of our existence, as well as of other creatures' existence. Therefore, as a given unchangeable fact, we can only accept it. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't fight against injustices and disease, but we cannot struggle against the inner structure of the world. It is beyond our limits and capabilities. Therefore, in my opinion, what a atheist can do, and in fact many do, is to evaluate as evil or good some aspect of the world. From here, they derive an optimistic or pessimistic position on life and on the world in general. For example, in order to defend existential optimism, we could argue that positive effects resulting from the basic organization of the world surpass the negative ones in quality or in quantity. Or we could contend that there are moral and psychological reasons to endorse an optimistic vision. Now, there is no time to discuss whether Silenus' words are right, nor to deepen the specific reason to sustain the existential optimism. What is important here is underline the fact that if the basic structure of the world is axiologically neutral, existential optimism can be safely affirmed against the existential problem of systemic evil. So, given the principle according to which the fundamental configuration, the fundamental constitution of the world is something that cannot be connoted as evil or God, atheists can evaluate the fact of this structure in an optimistic or pessimistic way on the basis of the rational consideration. Surely, they have to provide coherent arguments to defend their positions in both cases, but existential optimism can be endorsed without falling into inconsistency. Sorry. But anyway, someone could be objected. There could be an objection. Sorry. My voice. This objection is the following. Also, atheists can desire or imagine living in a better world. For example, Dawkins says, this world is one of the countless virtually possible worlds that could have arisen. Atheists, like theists, consider this world included its law and natural processes, contingent and unnecessary. So an atheist can judge evil the system of nature, compare it with another and better logically possible world. Therefore, my criticism fails, since it is based on the assumption that natural selection is an unterrible feature of the world and what is necessarily given cannot be deemed as evil or good. In my opinion, this objection is valid only from a pure and formal point of view, logical point of view. Logically, an atheist can conceive a different world, but from an ontological point of view, given the atheistic ontology, the actual world is the only ontologically possible reality. The cosmos with its structure is the only world we have and will have. It is a matter of fact that cannot be changed at ontological level. So, asking for a very different universe means asking for a completely different existence in which we are totally dissimilar from our actual beings, in which we are no more ourselves. The point is that the atheistic desire to live in a world without the presence of natural selection is an aspiration possible to be realized. It is a sort of childish wish. It is more similar to a childish wish than a rational belief. Hence, the longing of some atheists to live in a better universe is not logically inconsistent. Rather, it is in contrast with their ontology, which affirms that this is the only possible reality we have. Therefore, if my reasoning is sound, for atheists, it is possible to respond to Nagasawa's criticism. If the systemic evil is in effect systemic, namely rooted in the structure of the universe, necessary, then it cannot be considered as evil nor as good. Axiological evaluation can be used to judge events or things in the world resulting from the fundamental configuration of reality. Therefore, Nagasawa's argument that is based on the acknowledgement of systemic evil fails. It can work only if an atheist evaluates a necessary aspect of the world as evil. But in this case, he will fall into an inconsistency not only according to Nagasawa's thesis, but also according to the atheistic ontology itself. Now, my question is, what's about theistic responses? We have seen an atheistic response to the problem of systemic evil. But what about theistic responses? What are theistic answers to the problem of systemic evil? In the second part, I'd like very briefly to discuss with you two approaches to the problem of evil: John Hick theodicy and process theodicy. These two approaches have been discussed in the previous meeting. The aim is to show that soul making theodicy, John Hick theodicy, doesn't give a satisfactory response to the problem of systemic evil, while process view seem able to offer an adequate solution, but a high price of modifying the classical divine attributes. Unfortunately, we have no time to explain all aspects and themes of these approaches, so I must limit myself to briefly recall few points in these theodicies that are important for our topic. So if something is not clear, if there are problem in understanding, just raise your hand or put your question during the public debate and I try to answer you. Okay, let's start with soul-making theodicy, John Hick theodicy. According to Hick theodicy, human beings are created by God originally as imperfect free beings, whose purpose is to grow morally and spiritually to reach similitude to die. I mean, a perfect, free, and loving relationship with their creator that is perfectly exemplified by the model of Christ. For this reason, God decided to bring about a world containing real perils and hardships, since in hedonistic paradise, humans would not be able to develop themselves at ethical and spiritual level. So a world devoid of problems and difficulties is a world in which it's not possible to help others, to be compassionate and generous. So it's not a place that is good for soul making, for our soul making, so for mature, from a moral, ethical, and spiritual point of view. But what is exposition regarding animal suffering? According to the philosopher, animal suffering is one of the most complex aspects of the problem of evil. They are not moral creatures, so the soul-making principle cannot be applied to them. Animals don't need to improve at ethical or spiritual level, nor the aim of their lives, like humans, is to enter in a personal loving relationship with God. Then the question is, why does a perfectly good God let them suffer, let animals suffer atrocious pains? He can identify the question of animal suffering with the question regarding their existence, finding a justification in the contribution that sentient life gives to the divine purpose for humanity. In other words, animals are an essential component within the natural system, since they help to form an autonomous world, guaranteeing the epistemic distance to human creatures. The concept of epistemic distance is essential within Hicks' theodicy. So I try to explain very quick this notion. According to Hicks, human beings are created in a sort of a cognitive distance from God. They are placed in an autonomous natural environment with its own independence laws, and where the divine presence is not immediately evident. So in other words, we live in a sort of religiously ambiguous universe. The epistemic distance ensures a free response to God. Otherwise, if God were completely visible, knowable, human creatures would be forced, would be obliged by the force of evidence to give their assent to God, to their creator. And therefore, their response would not be completely free. So, Hicks' theodicy argues that animal life is an important part of the natural environment, because it contributes to constitute the organic world as an important part of this system and as an independent system, where humans' lives and to which are deeply linked. So, this perspective is anthropocentric and subordinates the animal's suffering to human existence. The world structure of the world, including animals, natural selection too, is organized to ensure cognitive freedom to human beings. The value of the organic life is evaluated in the light of its role for humanity. Now, what is the problem inside this perspective? That this view doesn't seem satisfying, since it's too anthropocentric. For example, according to David Ray Griffin, Hicks gives to animals an instrumental value, but the position is quite difficult to hold. In fact, it seems problematic to condemn the millions of years of suffering caused by the evolution have been permitted only for the sake of humanity, especially in the light of the concept of the divine goodness. If God created ex nihilo, as Griffin, why didn't he bring about simultaneously and instantaneously the natural environment in order to avoid millions of years of pain? There is not an explanation for this. It's not clear why God decided to create the world using the way of natural selection, so causing gratuitous and horrendous evil to animals before the emergence of humanity in the world. So Hicks' vision is vitiated by a strong anthropocentrism that not only doesn't provide a good explanation for those millions of years of painful evolution preceding human emergence in the world, but is unable to justify the moral goodness of God with regard to animal suffering. Therefore, it's not clear why they have to suffer, only animals have to suffer in this atrocious way, and for what reason God permitted. Hicks' view is instrumental, but I wonder how a perfect good can use animal as means. But there is a different approach that is represented by process theodicy. This approach seems able to solve both the problem of animal suffering and the evil of natural selection. Even in this case, we have no time to discuss all themes and aspects of this complex philosophical and theological view. We have discussed it in the previous meeting. So I must limit myself to just recall a few points that are important for our actual topic. according to process theodicy, God doesn't create ex nihilo, but create out of chaos. So, process theodicy denies the traditional doctrine of the creation out of nothing, endorsing a vision that sustained the creation out of chaos. So, in other words, God broke a cosmos out of initial chaotic condition. He shaped the cosmos according to some eternal metaphysical principle, with the aim to prompt the world toward the highest levels of beauty, harmony, and complexity. So creation is a sort of a key activity that gradually brings order in the primordial chaos, moving from the simplest form of life to the most complex one. Second point, the original stuff that composes the world is not a static and passive material in God's hand, like a sort of clay for the potter. Instead, it embeds creativity. This concept of creativity or creative power is twofold. It is the power of self-determination or final causation, and it is the ability, the power of determining others or influencing others, so it's also called efficient causation. This power is an ultimate metaphysical principle inherent to the nature of things. This means that the power of self-determination and others' determination is not a divine gift, but is an essential element inherent to the very nature of things beyond God's vocative power. This means that each single being in the world possesses this twofold power, the power of self-determination and the power to influence others. So, process God doesn't possess a coercive power to bring about any logically possible situation or state of affair. Rather, he has got a sort of a persuasive power. He has the possibility, the ability, the capacity to prompt, to lure creatures toward the best possibility of existence, toward the best opportunity of enjoyment. So, this is clear not a traditional conception of God, especially of divine omnipotence. God is not omnipotent in a traditional meaning. His omnipotence is a sort of persuasive omnipotence. It's not a coercive omnipotence or absolute omnipotence. So, given this onto metaphysical framework, ontological metaphysical framework, it becomes clear that God has no responsibility for the evolutionary process. He has not determined the inner structure of the world, nor has the power to intervene to prevent, if not at all, almost the worst forms of evil caused by natural selection, nor he has the power to stop the process in itself of natural selection. Moreover, according to process theodicies, there are some necessary and eternal metaphysical principles at the basis of the world that rule the development of the cosmos. One of these principles establishes that given the essential relationship among all creatures, the more complex form of life presupposes simple form of life. It means that a complex world like ours, like this, can arise and develop itself only through a long step-by-step process. There is a sort of order among the existential possibilities. Each new level of existence needs the stable actualization of inferior levels as its support and basic condition. So, only when a certain level reaches a certain stability, it is possible to move up to the next steps. In other words, I cannot jump from stage 1 to stage 4, but stage 2 and stage 3 are required, and so they have to come in between. In conclusion, process position seems more plausible than Higgs. It provides a sound explanation for the problem of systemic evil that is able to free God from the responsibility of evil natural selection. Given the process metaphysical framework and the persuasive nature of the divine power, God cannot determine the basic structure of the world, nor its inner processes. Therefore, he cannot be blamed for having created a world containing systemic evil. On the other hand, God is constantly at work to eradicate evils from the world. So, at first sight, this view seems acceptable, seems adequate to express and to explain, to respond to the problem of systemic evil. But there are some remaining difficulties. We have no time to deepen all the problems behind this vision, so I limit myself to just to make two problems. First, my question is, does process theodicy really solve the problem of systemic evil? This difficulty arises from a traditional conception of the divine attributes, especially the divine omnipotence, and sees an apparent incompatibility between a perfectly powerful moral God and the presence of systemic evil in the world. Process view modifies the classical notion of omnipotence. But is this operation satisfying? It seems that process theodicy, instead of directly answering to the question, is it in its own terms, as it has been originally formulated, tries to change these terms in order to offer an acceptable solution. But I wonder whether it is a sort of evasive strategy to elude the core of the problem. There is another big question that regards the problem of predation. As Gary Charter underlined in his article, the violent system of predation represents a great challenge for process theology. In fact, predation seems to be at the basis of the evolutionary process. In fact, the predator method is one of the main ways in which natural selection works, is clear. Charters ask whether process God promotes predation as a means to reach his purposes or not. Namely, its purpose is to prompt the world towards the highest level of harmony, complexity, and beauty. And so God's aim is to prompt the world towards ever more complex form of existence. Gary Charter asks if God used as a method, as a way, as a strategy, predation to reach this aim. We have two possibilities. In the first case, if God promotes predation, the divine promotion of predation will be inconsistent with the process notion of a perfect loving deity who loves and takes care of each single creature in the world. God uses as means animals, his creator, to reach his own aim. In the second case, if God doesn't promote predation and endeavors to force an animal towards other possibilities, then process deity doesn't seem to succeed in doing this. The predatory instinct and system are so spread and fundamental in nature that it seems that no animal follows the divine lure, the divine urge to know prey. So the final question are that, and the final problem that, in my opinion, process theodicy at the end is only apparently, only at the first sight, able to solve the problem of systemic evil and the problem of natural evil. Systemic evil represents one of the most challenging problems, both for theism and for atheism. Like all great philosophical questions, for example, the mind-body problem or the foundation of morality, many answers have been given, but no one seems entirely satisfying. So perhaps what we should do is to continue to search. So thank you. Thank you. Okay.
I think we can proceed in this way. You can react to the, especially to the objections of the first part of the talk of Sophia, in 10 minutes, if you can, and then we can open the public discussion. Okay, facciamo 10 minuti di risposta del professor Nakazawa alle obiezioni di Sofia e poi apriamo la discussione pubblica e abbiamo tempo abbastanza, più di mezz'ora per porre domande e ascoltare le risposte. Le domande possono essere poste poi naturalmente sia a Nakazawa sia a Sofia Vescovelli.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to translate.
Yeah, translate. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, I'm very grateful to Sofia for her very interesting and useful and intellectually stimulating comments on my paper.
Ringrazio Sofia Vescovelli per il suo interessante e scusate. Sì, ha ragione. Ringrazio Sofia per il suo intervento che è intellettualmente molto stimolante ed interessante.
So I think I agree with Sofia that if naturalism is true, then the laws of nature are somehow more rigid. So it's somewhat comparable to mathematical facts.
Nonostante io sia d'accordo con Sofia nell'idea che le leggi naturali siano necessary contingent, non contingent,
right.
Non sono contingenti.
Yeah, so in the naturalistic framework, there is only this physical universe and this given laws of nature. So it seems a little bit strange to consider alternative options for naturalists.
So, quindi, visto che il quadro, diciamo, ontologico ateo dice che il mondo è dato, sembra strano pensare a altri mondi possibili.
So there is no God that tries to create an alternative possible world with different laws of nature, or God that intervenes in our affair in this world.
Cioè non c'è un Dio che crea altri mondi possibili con altre leggi, né c'è un Dio che può intervenire nel modificare la struttura ontologica di Dio e del mondo, scusate.
So for naturalists, it seems that facts in nature seem to be comparable to mathematical facts because they seem to be necessary.
I fatti della natura, per un punto di vista naturalistico, sono comparabili a delle leggi matematiche nella loro necessità, nel fatto che non possono essere modificati.
And I think Sofia is right in saying that mathematical facts are neither good nor bad; they're neutral.
E sono d'accordo quindi con Sofia quando dice che i fatti matematici non sono né buoni né cattivi, ma sono neutrali.
But I'm not sure if that applies to natural facts as well.
Okay, ma non sono sicuro che si possa applicare questa visione ai fatti naturali.
So for example, many theists would say that it is necessarily true that God is all loving.
Per esempio, molti credenti, molti teisti sostengono che è necessariamente vero che Dio è perfettamente un Dio perfettamente amorevole, che ama di un amore perfetto.
And some people might think that it's good that necessarily God is all loving, even though that fact is necessarily true and we cannot change it.
Ok, quindi molte persone pensano che sia, insomma, che Dio sia perfettamente buono, che sia una cosa buona questa, e che questo fatto non si possa cambiare.
So I want to question Sophia's assumption that all necessary truths are neither good nor bad.
Sofia sembra assumere che tutti i fatti necessari non sono né buoni né cattivi.
So that was my response to the first part of Sophia's comment, response to my paper.
Questo è la mia prima risposta al mio intervento alla replica di Sofia.
And so Sophia addressed Hicks theodicy and process theodicy in the second half of her comment response to my paper.
Sophia poi si riferisce anche alla teodicea di Hicks e alla teodicea processuale nella seconda parte del suo discorso.
And I agree with her that Hicks' response to the problem of natural evil is weak.
E sono d'accordo con lei nel sostenere che la risposta di Hicks al problema del male naturale è debole.
So even if God requires to have epistemic distance from us, it doesn't seem necessary for God to create such a violent and unfair system of natural selection.
Anche se per Dio è necessario creare un mondo che abbia una distanza epistemica, quindi per mantenere l'uomo a distanza epistemica, non sembra affatto necessario per Dio dover creare un mondo che contenga così tanta violenza e ingiustizia.
So I think Sophia is right in saying that he gives instrumental value to animals in his theodicy.
Penso che Sofia abbia ragione quando dice che sostiene che Hicks dà un valore strumentale alla sofferenza degli animali, all'esistenza degli animali.
But I also wonder if soul-making theodicists can improve their theodicy somehow.
Ma mi chiedo se è possibile per i sostenitori della soul-making theodicy migliorare la propria posizione.
So maybe they can incorporate evolution into their soul-making theodicy.
Potrebbero, per esempio, incorporare nella loro visione, nella loro teodicea, l'evoluzione.
So this is a highly speculative claim, but maybe they can say that the whole evolutionary process of organisms represents the process of soul-making.
Per esempio, questo speculativamente parlando, potremmo pensare che il sistema, il processo dell'evoluzione rispecchia il processo di soul making, quindi il processo di formazione dell'anima.
But probably that kind of view requires some further assumptions, such as reincarnation of organisms over time.
Però probabilmente questa visione inevitabilmente richiede delle assunzioni ulteriori, come per esempio la reincarnazione in altre vite, eccetera, eccetera.
So I'm not defending this view, but I was just wondering if soul-making theodicists can improve their theory by incorporating evolution.
Quindi io non sto difendendo questa posizione, mi sto semplicemente chiedendo se sia possibile per i sostenitori della teologia, della formazione dell'anima migliorare la propria posizione incorporando certi elementi.
And Sophia also talked about process theology. So I think she's right in saying that if we accept the process concept of God, then the problem of evil is eliminated.
Io penso che poi Sofia ha parlato della teologia processuale e penso che abbia ragione quando sostiene che se noi accettiamo il concetto processuale di Dio, il male è eliminato, però non il male è eliminato.
Because the problem of evil is a problem for theists who think that God is omnipotent and morally perfect.
Perché il problema del male è per i credenti, per i teisti che sostengono che Dio è perfettamente onnipotente, perfettamente buono.
So I think in a way process theology is an easy solution to the problem of evil because they just give up the traditional concept of God.
Ritengo quindi che la soluzione processuale sia una soluzione facile al problema del male perché abbandona il concetto dell'onnipotenza divina.
But I'm not sure if process theists can escape the existential problem of systemic evil.
Ma non sono sicuro che la teologia processuale possa sfuggire dal problema esistenziale del male sistemico.
Because the existential problem arises for anyone, so it, you know, people don't necessarily need to endorse the existence of God.
Perché il problema del esistenziale del male sistemico in realtà è un problema per tutti. Quindi Quindi anche per coloro che non sostengono l'esistenza di Dio, che non credono nell'esistenza di Dio.
So as long as process theists affirm existential optimism and the existence of natural selection.
Quindi nel momento in cui i processuali sostengono l'esistenza di Dio e l'ottimismo esistenziale e la presenza del male nella selezione naturale.
Yes, so as long as they have these two things, they have to respond to the existential problem So process theists, as long as they affirm existential optimism natural selection, they have to face this problem.
Ah, devono affrontare questo problema, quindi.
So even if they give up the traditional concept of God, it seems that they still have to face this existential problem.
Quindi anche se loro abbandonano il tradizionale concetto di Dio, comunque devono affrontare il problema esistenziale del male sistemico.
So it seems to me that the existential problem arises for atheists, traditional theists, and even for process theists.
Quindi mi sembra che il problema esistenziale del male sistemico in realtà sia tale non solo per i teisti tradizionali, per i non credenti, per i non teisti, ma anche per i filosofi processuali, per i teologi processuali.
That's all.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Domande.
Start.
So I would like to thank you both very much. I found both speeches very, very interesting, and so for me it was very important to learn a lot from you both. And I was just wondering if we assume systemic evil as a necessary premise, and it seems to me after your speeches that we have to assume it. So shouldn't we just abandon the optimistic point of view, and regardless of the question whether atheist or theist are better positioned or not, or whatever, but shouldn't our first step just be, okay, let's abandon the optimistic point of view, which is very irrational. And I was also very impressed by the fact that indeed the argument that normally people developed in order to defend the optimistic point of view are very similar, and they can both lead to the atheist, to the atheistic point of view, or to the theistic point of view. And I was impressed by the fact that Enrico Fermi, a very famous Italian physician, the one who led the Manhattan Project in the U.S., in his diary wrote that when he was young, once he was spending his summer with some peasants, some very simple people, and they were looking at the Milky Way, and they were, all of them, they were saying, okay, there should be a God. And it is the same argument that Dawkins uses for the atheist point of view, or for the optimistic point of view, but then he is an atheist. So from the optimistic point of view, we can both be atheist or theist. This is not important. So my first question is, shouldn't we abandon the optimistic point of view? And the second question is, if we still want to be theist, shouldn't we totally exit this question? And couldn't we be theist from a pessimistic point of view? And because otherwise it seems to me that theism has no rational ground to be defended. It just seems a fairy tale to continue to argue the optimistic point of view, but we have no rational argument, no rational proof that there is actually something like a transcendent God, an afterlife, and all that, because, okay, we just have systemic evil. And on the other side, I think there are very important arguments that allow us to be pessimistic and at the same time to support a theistic point of view. And I would say, so the point of view that we have, for example, from the Bible, it is in some way a pessimistic point of view. So we have a lot of stories of people that do not have a very happy life. And so Jesus is maybe the most important example, but already in the Jewish Bible, so the very famous book of Hiob is an example of a very pessimistic point of view in regard to life. So if we want to keep a theistic point of view, we should assume the pessimistic point of view and then develop some other argument. A very last thing, I think the traditional doctrine in the Christian theology that has the name of the felix culpa, the happy sin, is exactly an apology argument that is referred to a systemic evil. So we have a first evil that affects all creation, that is the original sin, and nevertheless this can be called happy. So we have a pessimistic point of view in regard to everything, to all history and to all creation, and nevertheless we can in some way be theistic. Thank you.
Io direi intanto di raccoglierne due o tre. We can take two or three questions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you answer. Okay. Allora, ci sono due domande e un'osservazione, diciamo così. La prima domanda è questa: presa coscienza del male sistemico, perché non abbandonare recisamente il punto di vista ottimistico sulla vita? Questo vale tanto per presa coscienza del male sistemico e che l'ottimismo può essere comune agli atei e ai teisti, e di fatto citava l'esempio di Enrico Fermi, che diceva che quando frequentava persone semplici che guardavano la Via Lattea sembrava possibile, se non necessario, che Dio ci fosse, data la magnificenza di quella visione. E questa visione di Enrico Fermi trova un parallelo interessante nella citazione di Dawkins del professor Nagasawa, per cui da un punto di vista questa volta ateo, tuttavia tale magnificenza porta la persona a essere grati della propria vita, di poter guardare questo stesso spettacolo meraviglioso. Per cui presa coscienza dell'indifferenza, diciamo così, dell'ottimismo esistenziale per il pensiero ateo e per il pensiero teista, perché a questo punto non rigettare recisamente l'ottimismo esistenziale se assumiamo la malvagità del sistema biologico inerente al mondo. La seconda domanda era questa: da un punto di vista cristiano, quindi siamo all'interno di una posizione teista, da punto di vista cristiano è coerente assumere il pessimismo esistenziale e la credenza in Dio? Non solo coerente, ma è un punto fondamentale del cristianesimo. E Francesco citava sia i libri dell'Antico Testamento, in particolare potremmo ricordare Giobbe, ecco, ma anche la stessa figura di Cristo, che vive un pessimismo esistenziale notevole e tuttavia tiene ferma l'idea di un Dio buono. Ci sono tantissimi personaggi nella Bibbia che vivono esistenzialmente dei dolori e delle sofferenze, e tuttavia, e anzi forse proprio per questo un po' lo aggiungo io, mantengono certa la loro fede in Dio. L'ultima suggestione interessante è che in effetti la dottrina tradizionale della felix culpa è una riformulazione, cioè può essere interpretata alla luce dell'argomento della scusa che ci ha presentato il professor Nagasawa, nel senso che la felice colpa dei primi peccatori umani del peccato originale ha fatto sì che tale colpa venisse redenta con la venuta del Cristo. Per cui in effetti la grande positività della venuta del Cristo giustifica in qualche modo moralmente la colpa originaria tale di Adamo ed Eva, tale che tale colpa possa essere definita felice perché ha permesso poi l'incarnazione di Dio nella storia. Può andare? Altre domande? Aspetti, c'è prima il professor Sorrentino, poi la...
I am very perplexed about your exposition because I found some failing points, which I would evidence to pose you questions. First one, is too anthropomorphic your idea of God. God is some being like a human being. I can't accept this. I can't work with such a notion of God. That's also for you the question. Then I found that you didn't clearly define the systemic evil. This is a non-consistent notion, because if there is a system, there could be any evil. What means evil in a system? If a system is existing, then there is no evil. The whole can't be without such things, such events, such energies, which are important for the substance of the system. So, what is evil system? What is evil? I can't understand. Another objection I would pose is that you continually interchange, pass through the modal concepts into real concepts. We can't make the modal notion and the modal judgments are not real judgments. We have to pay attention to this, otherwise we can't understand nothing. And thirdly, also the concept of creation. I think this is very, very far from my what I would understand as creation. That to say, creation is not an activity within a system. Is the activity that is giving a being to a system. It's outside. It's excessive. It's transcended the system. That is right also for the creation of nature. If nature is an autonomous being, then creation is outside, transcended to this autonomy. Otherwise, I can't understand what we are speaking of. Endly, the problem of evil, already Leibniz thought that evil we could understand with evil the finite is finite, very evil, but finite, the finite being includes the passivity and the activity. Someone is active, another one is passive, is resisting against this activity. Evil is something like this. I don't understand. I don't think so. Or the physical evil That's a notion we could pay attention to, because the physical evil, we name it evil, but why it's evil? Because it's a suffering, but suffering presupposes something good. That to say, I can feel the feeling. To say so, it's not the same as the finitude of a being. And another one, the moral evil. Are we speaking, when we speak of God, that he could create a world without evil? Which evil? Without moral evil, he could make. But at told once Kant, create some puppets, not free beings. I believe that there are issues you have to face.
Allora sì, ci sono molte questioni, provo a riassumerle chiedendo anche l'aiuto del professore se non me le ricordo tutte. Allora, la prima obiezione è questa: il Dio di cui sta parlando il professor Nagasawa è un Dio eccessivamente antropomorfo ed è una concezione legata a certe religioni positive che non può valere per tutto il framework teista in cui Dio può essere pensato anche in altri modi. Seconda obiezione, lui passa senza soluzione di continuità dal modale al reale, mentre invece il professore vorrebbe che tale differenza fosse mantenuta, mentre gli sembra che nella relazione non è stata mantenuta. Altra obiezione, la creazione implica di fatto, se si usa il concetto di creazione, una trascendenza rispetto alla natura. Rispetto al sistema. Ecco, un'altra obiezione era questa, che però era la seconda che ho lasciato da parte, però poteva anche rientrare in quella di Sofia, forse, cioè che se c'è un sistema non c'è un male, c'è soltanto una legge del sistema che deve essere osservata senza valutarla moralmente. Potremmo anche riformulare questo come una forma di fallacia naturalistica, ma adesso non apriamo la di fallacia naturalistica, cioè si passa dal naturale, dal descrittivo, a una valutazione morale sul fatto. L'ultima obiezione riguardava il male. Già Leibniz precisava che il male non può essere pensato semplicemente, meramente come un meccanismo di attività e passività. Sì, come finitudine, anche il male fisico ha dei problemi ad essere pensato semplicemente come sofferenza, perché implica una concezione di sensibilità. L'ultima suggestione era invece una riproposizione di una soluzione anche presente nella storia della filosofia e della teologia, faceva riferimento a Kant in particolare, per cui se Dio non avesse creato il mondo e in particolare gli uomini così come sono, cioè anche capaci di male, avrebbe creato dei fantocci e non degli uomini liberi, per cui la libertà sarebbe condizione necessaria perché l'uomo sia veramente cioè il male è condizione necessaria per la libertà umana, ecco, sostanzialmente. Riprendiamo un'altra, poi facciamo rispondere, se no ci sono troppe domande.
Thank you very much. Sarò molto breve, mi può fare translation lei? Allora io chiedo, non voglio rimanere nel concetto razionale. Allora le chiedo, mi sono notato, che cos'è la verità in religione e se si può mentire nella religione. La ringrazio.
Ok. He's asking what is truth in religion and it's possible to lie in religion.
Rely.
To lie. In religion. In religion, yes. So what is the concept of truth in religion and the possible of lying in...
It's a big question.
So...
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much. So there are a lot of interesting points, and I don't think I can address all of them, but can I focus on some key questions?
Vi ringrazio per le domande che sono molto interessanti. Cercherò insomma di concentrarmi sulle risposte di rispondervi al meglio.
So in response to the first one, so I wrote this paper because I was quite interested in the fact that now there is a growing population of people who are not religious but spiritual.
In risposta alla prima, ho scritto questo paper perché c'è un numero crescente di persone che non sono religiose ma stanno diventando spirituali.
So as you were saying, I think you're right that if you look at Dawkins, he's almost like a theist. He just rejects the existence of a personal God. But what he says is almost like theist. He's fascinated by nature and he feels that he should even worship nature.
Se per esempio pensiamo a Dawkins, lui scrive, parla, si comporta come un ateo, ma per altri versi, quando guarda la natura, la bellezza della natura, rimane insomma impressionato e ha quasi un senso di adorazione, esattamente si comporta come un credente.
So that's why I thought that if there is an existential problem of theists, we can apply the same problem for atheists as well.
Ed è per questo che penso che ci sia un problema esistenziale sia per i teisti che come si può applicare anche a non credenti.
Now, you suggested that maybe we can just reject existential optimism. So maybe we can just embrace pessimism and then we can consistently hold the systemic evil.
Quindi tu suggerisci di semplicemente abbandonare l'ottimismo esistenzialista in modo da evitare la contraddizione che c'è tra l'ottimismo esistenziale e il male sistemico e quindi di poter abbracciare tranquillamente il male sistemico.
And you said that there are certain theists who accept pessimism, but it seems to me that they accept pessimism about our life on Earth, but not necessarily about afterlife and the overall picture. So I would think that they are overall still optimists.
Quindi lui dice, tu sostieni che anche i non credenti, i credenti sono pessimisti, ma in realtà a me sembra che i credenti siano pessimisti riguardo la vita su questa terra, non invece nella vita, nella realtà, nel complesso, quindi da un punto di vista più ampio, da una prospettiva più ampia.
And so I think this kind of reasoning entails what I had here as well. So theists can hold overall optimism, while atheists cannot, because they cannot appeal to anything beyond the physical universe.
Quindi questo ragionamento sembra assumere che gli atei possono abbracciare l'ottimismo perché inevitabilmente hanno una prospettiva più ampia, mentre invece i non credenti no, perché non hanno possibilità di comparare con ho capito bene? No, giusto? Non l'ho capito. Ok. Non l'avevo potrei aver capito male. Ok. Sorry, yes, it's right.
Yeah. And moving on to the next one. Okay, there are a lot of points about anthropomorphism. I agree with you. If you look at the problem of evil traditionally formulated, it looks like there is a strong emphasis on anthropomorphism. So the problem of evil says that the existence of evil is incompatible with God, who is supposed to remove these evil events.
Quindi io sono d'accordo con lei perché effettivamente è molto antropomorfico questa visione e il tradizionale concetto del problema del male proprio presuppone che Dio debba rimuovere i mali dal mondo, quindi è molto antropomorfico.
So I often think that in this kind of debate people just assume that God is like Superman.
Quindi gli uomini semplicemente assumono in questa posizione che Dio sia una sorta di Superman.
So God is supposed to rescue people who are suffering or stop earthquakes and so on. And I think that is a form of anthropomorphism.
E quindi si pensa che Dio debba insomma salvare le persone dai terremoti o da altre catastrofi e sì, certo, questa è una forma di antropomorfismo.
So I think overall I agree with you that there is some certain assumptions in the whole debate that can be questioned because God is not meant to be like humans or superhumans.
Quindi sono d'accordo con lei nel momento in cui ci sono delle assunzioni in questo discorso che possono essere assolutamente che sono discutibili. Per esempio l'idea che Dio sia come gli uomini, comunque debba salvare tutti gli uomini.
Another thing about moral judgment and real judgment. I'm not really sure the exact distinction between these two, because we often make real judgments on the basis of moral reasoning.
Sorry, can you rephrase?
The moral judgment and real judgment. And for me, it looks like we often make real judgments on the basis of moral reasoning.
Okay. Per quanto riguarda invece la questione del ragionamento modale e concetti invece reali, a me sembra che noi normalmente, quando ragioniamo concetti reali, lo facciamo sul presupposto dei concetti modali.
Because, for example, we say that you know, it's bad that something, you know, we make a judgment that something is bad because this kind of event could have been prevented.
Quindi, per esempio, quando noi diciamo che una cosa è negativa, un evento è negativo, è male perché avrebbe potuto essere prevenuto, essere evitato.
We make a moral claim on the basis of what could have been the case.
Noi esprimiamo un giudizio morale, un'affermazione morale sulla base di quello che avrebbe potuto essere.
So philosophers often make, you know, crazy moral claims that have nothing to do with the reality, but there are other examples of moral claims that are in fact relevant to reality.
Quindi in alcuni casi molti filosofi costituiscono dei sistemi modali che sono molto folli e che non hanno nulla a che fare con la realtà, ma in altri casi ci sono sistemi modali che invece sono compatibili con la realtà.
What else? Should we move on to the final question? Sorry.
Creation.
What was the question about creation?
Yeah. So the fact that God, when
creation is not nature, it's
different.
Nature plus God.
Something separate. So the very meaning of creation entails the idea that God is something other and separated from the thing created. And so the thing created is something autonomous.
Uh-huh. And that God, in the theistic picture.
Gli ho detto sostanzialmente che la sua domanda.
Qual è il problema? Perché lui avrebbe fatto
sì, perché pensa alla creazione come interno al sistema.
Ok,
perché la creazione è quello che istituisce il sistema.
According to him, you think creation as something that is inside the system, while the creation is something that give rise to the system.
Yeah,
so
I think I agree with you. Yeah, so I would say that if there...
mistake that you commit according
to... posso esprimere in maniera sintetica?
Sì.
Se io penso un sistema è formato da una funzione.
Ok.
Vabbè, la funzione crea il sistema. Questo è anche in matematica.
Sì.
A tutti i livelli. Se io invece penso alla creazione come una funzione del sistema, io lo messo dentro al sistema.
Ok, quindi...
invece eccede... anche la funzione del sistema.
Okay, creation is exceeding the system, so it's like a function that creates a system. It's not the function is not inside the system.
Right.
But the function also in mathematics create the system.
Questa è la creazione da nulla, è questo.
So creation out of nothing else means that God created a thing that is completely different from him, and so the creation is not the system. You identify or anyway put creation inside the system.
Okay, so I, if I understood correctly, I agree with you that God is prior to the system. So if God created the system, then God is not placed within the system.
Quindi io sono d'accordo con lei nel momento in cui si sostiene che Dio è prima della creazione, quindi Dio ha creato e non è il sistema, non è.
God is a function of this system.
Yeah.
But then that sounds like God exists within the system. I thought God was independent from the system, who initiated the birth of the system.
Quindi Dio inizia, è indipendente e inizia la creazione, il sistema.
And setting aside anthropomorphism, if that is correct, then God seems to be responsible for this system. Because God is the cause of the system.
Ok, quindi lasciando a perdere la questione antropomorfica, comunque Dio sembra responsabile per il sistema, perché comunque ha dato avvio al sistema, anche se è una cosa indipendente, ha dato avvio al sistema, quindi è responsabile per il sistema.
The same question: God could create another world, another different from this. Is failure, is fallacia.
It's fallacious.
It's
fallacious.
The genuine notion of creation.
I mean, yeah, so you could question that. So Leibniz thinks that, you know, at the beginning God had all sorts of possibilities and he decided to create this specific universe because he thought that this is the best one. But of course you can question this whole picture, which again looks quite anthropomorphic, and if you adopt a different account of creation, this whole picture is completely wrong.
Quindi Leibniz ha deciso di creare quel mondo specifico rispetto a tutti gli altri mondi, diciamo, che potremmo. È anthropomorphic according to the system. Io mi sono persa, scusa.
Vabbè, andiamo avanti.
Final question: what is truth and falsity in religion? That's a major question, and I'm not sure how to answer it. I guess we do philosophy because we want to find out what is true and what is false, what is the truth, what kind of knowledge we can acquire about the world and something beyond this physical world.
La sua è una grandissima questione, una delle più grandi questioni filosofiche, e quindi tutti i filosofi appunto diatribano sul fatto di che cosa sia la verità, che cosa sia la falsità, di come posso io raggiungere la verità, come noi possiamo conoscere le cose vere, eccetera, eccetera.
Okay. Hai una domanda? Sì. Sì, abbiamo ancora un po' di tempo.
Okay, thank you first of all for the interesting paper. I have just a very small clarification to ask you. So in zero regard, I don't know if you can come back to the slide where there is the paradox of Thompson.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
If you can come back to the slide.
Okay. Yes, slide.
Yeah.
The paradox.
Yes, so in regard to the conclusion, you say on the hand that, well, the theistic position in truth is... okay. Yes, thank you. Okay. You say as conclusion that maybe in this perspective, after all analysis, it results that seems to you that the theistic position is stronger than the atheism. I mean, reading Hall and also the perspective, I'm not totally agree, because I think that the atheistic in truth is stronger than theistic if you consider it the systemic evil. Okay. And so what I want to ask is first, which is your consideration of this God? What is God in this presentation for you exactly? Because also connected to the topic of the conference, so how we can know God. So it means that it seems impossible, also in the theistic perspective here, to know who is God. And on the other part, in an atheistic perspective, it is smarter, because why we need this God that is totally useless, because to explain, he is not able to explain why we have to suffer. He is also useless to explain the problem of the heaven in the world in general. And so I'm not also agree with the theistic perspective of Tommasi, because in the other sense it's stupid to be theistic. If I have to be pessimistic, if I have to believe in something, well. And the other part, I agree also with the Sophia when you argue in your response that, well, the ground of an atheistic ontology in truth is not compatible with the theistic perspective, of course, but the ground that for an atheistic perspective is not able to surround all the system, okay? And so why I ask you to come back to this slide, because I think that here, use the strategic also vision that is the normal way of doing metaphysics also in the US, well, there are a few hundred books, and on to explain well the structure of the reality, consider this possible world. Okay, so it, maybe it can be this possible world in which etc. But this doesn't help me to understand the real world here and why there is evil, because evil is connected not to a possible world. And we could check and imagine, well, peace, there is no God because it's unnecessary. I'm very okay. I don't want to trust anyone else. I have not the necessity to believe in something else because there is peace, there is the well, there is all facts are good. So there is the goodness, okay, in that world. And so also I can imagine a world, paradoxically, without the necessity of God. But in this world, well, how can I can explain evil use this way of escape in some sort of sense with the imagination of this other possible world in which, and so in this way I can also admit the fact that there are injustice on one hand and on the other one, well, I'm here and my father was Jewish and met my mom that was in Australia thanks to the Holocaust and so on, okay? But on the other part, that's what happened. And so what I'm interested in just to understand also the evil in this concrete world. And I think that the end of the world presentation that, well, I was very impressed, so really thank you, but, well, I don't really understand how you can affirm that the deistic position in this, consider the system of evil, is stronger than the atheistic position. Because, in truth, God, why we need him? I mean, if it works in this way, okay. So it's just a small clarification, so thank you.
Sì, devo tradurre. Allora provo a riassumere brevemente. Uno non sembra a Elisa che sia giustificata la conclusione della relazione del professore Nagasawa, cioè che i teisti, insomma i credenti possano avere maggiori risorse per fronteggiare il problema dell'esistenza del male sistemico e mantenere un ottimismo esistenziale rispetto agli atei, perché in effetti per gli atei questo problema non si porrebbe, e da qui la domanda su quale Dio viene implicato nell'intera relazione del professor Nagasawa. E poi c'era una domanda sempre sulla passaggio dal modale al reale, cioè riguardo a questo modo di risolvere il problema facendo leva sulla concezione modale dei mondi possibili, si tenta un escabotage per non rispondere al problema del male effettivo nel mondo, al male reale nel mondo, e si cerca un escamotage modale che ce lo renda in qualche modo accettabile, ma in realtà questa spiegazione è inefficace perché è su di un piano che non è quello del male reale. Più o meno posso... Ok. There is any other question here? I have a final one. Ok. Un'altra. Fammene fare una a me.
Ma io mi trovo abbastanza fuori da questo mondo, essendo un naturalista di formazione. E dal punto di vista scientifico non esiste un processo evolutivo finalizzato. Tutte le specie che vivono sono al top in questo momento nella storia evolutiva. Non vivono in funzione delle altre, ma vivono in funzione di se stesse. Quindi non esiste non si può ammettere scientificamente una finalità per questa specie o per quest'altra. Tutte sono viventi, chi è vivente vive il successo del evolutivo. Quindi non esiste.
Devo tradurre io? Oh, ok, no, perché sennò poi mi dimentico, quindi la forma un attimo, traduco e poi dopo lei continua. Sì. Mi dispiace, mi scusi, perché sennò poi non riesco a farla seriamente. So, according to a naturalist, he's a scientist, he's a naturalist. According to him, from a naturalistic point of view, there is no finalism in nature.
There is no
finalism in nature. There is no end. Teleology. Okay. Teleological end. Okay. There is no teleological end. Finalism in nature. But every single creature actually is at the top level. So there is not a sort of movement towards the best creatures, the best of the top mm-hmm. creatures, but every single beings actually are is at the top of the net of the nature of the level of creation. So there is not sort of a teleological movement mm-hmm. towards something, mm-hmm. toward a final end. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Quando poi io ho letto la relazione, quello che ho potuto, quando noi diamo un giudizio per esempio di male nella lotta biologica, parlava degli icneumonidi che naturalmente mettono avvelenano la larva e la fanno morire lentamente, è il massimo della crudeltà, anche questo è comunque un giudizio sulla creazione, okay. È un giudizio schiera, ammette già okay. una presenza di bene e di male. Okay. Allora, un conto è giudicare il mondo, un conto è giudicare la creazione di Dio.
Okay.
Su questo fronte, dal punto di vista teistico, mi vengono in mente le due suggestioni di Joseph Leibowitz, un ebreo, maestro di Amos Luzzato, il quale dice gli episodi... quando noi condanniamo il mondo, in realtà esprimiamo un giudizio sul mondo che è un giudizio su Dio, sulla creazione. E questo è il peccato di idolatria. Cioè noi non lo possiamo fare questo. La natura dell'uomo, che crede in Dio, è quello di esprimere il culto a Dio, punto e basta. La fede per Abramo, per Giobbe, e sono questi i percorsi, è una fede per sé. Non ammette nessuna valutazione, okay. Si fa il bene perché è bene, punto.
E il male? E il male? Come si fa?
Viviamo nel male, percorsi dal male, siamo soggetti al male, siamo creature. No, no, ma questo è il percorso che si fa, questo è evidente. Questo. No. Però non so che non è bello, però dice, la fede per sé... quando Abramo viene chiamato è assurdo, insomma, il percorso di Abramo verso il Monte Moira per l'uccisione del figlio, è un assurdo logico, è il male, insomma. Ma la fede di Abramo viene giudicata e fatta perché si sottomette, ma non dà un giudizio, cerca in tutti i modi di scappare comunque, cioè di non farlo il male.
Su Giobbe sarebbe un po' più complicata la faccenda, però.
It's an event, and so we cannot judge from a theological point of view, pure finalist point of view, we cannot judge the creation. And so it's a sort of idolatric mm-hmm. attitude that is
I have a final question. That is the opposite one of the opposite one of Francesco, and opposite also to the last question. The question is, why don't reject the not the optimistic position about life, but the pessimistic explanation of natural phenomena? So why don't interpret it the Darwinian orthodox framework like an historical scientific approach that is not the true mm-hmm. truth about nature. Mm-hmm. There is a big return of teleology in the biology. For example, the explanation of the epigenetics. There are, in a way, a sort of neo-Lamarckism, the epigenetics, or the endosymbiosis, cellular endosymbiosis, like our mitochondria are bacterium that are entered in our cells, have a different DNA, different genetic code. So are two different species combined to survive each other. Another topic of the contemporary vision of nature is the famous Gaia hypothesis, that is a return of teleology in some way. There are not only competition, struggle for survival, but also cooperation for survival. Life is possible in the world thanks to the activity of living beings that cooperate to maintain certain values like the average temperature, the salinity of the oceans, something like that, that are necessary for the presence of life on the Earth. So there is a cooperation for a goal that is exactly the presence of life. We can interpret it this like neo-Leibnizian or naturalistic Leibnizian vision. So this is the best possible world in which best is possible for life. All these new theories about natures are not very full integrated in a Darwinian framework for these reasons. So we have two possibilities. We can say if I am the orthodox Darwinian, like Dawkins, these are new pseudo-religions to make life possible for us because we don't want to accept the evil in nature. But there is another possibility to think about this new, also new discoveries in science. That is, maybe Darwinian framework itself is a historical way to regard to the nature, determined, for example, by a bourgeois way of life in which the competition is the most important thing. I am against the other for my success. That goal is my success, my survival, against the other. And it's interesting that now this vision of Gaia cooperation is exactly in the era of the web, of the internet. And the web is the great metaphor of these visions. Okay. Thanks. Ah, sì, la domanda è questa. Perché invece non rigettare la visione sistemica del male? Ci sono diverse opzioni per guardare alla natura, anche opzioni scientifiche, che non possono essere integrate completamente nel modello darwiniano. Una è l'epigenetica, che sta riscuotendo sempre maggiore successo, adesso non posso soffermarmi, ma è una specie di visione neolamarchiana della natura, per cui il DNA configura delle possibilità e l'adattamento, quindi le condizioni ambientali modificano gli stessi processi di produzione proteica, e tali processi divengono nella generazione successiva preferenziali rispetto agli altri, per cui c'è una noi trasmettiamo non soltanto il codice ma anche delle vie preferenziali di fenotipo. L'altra questione è la simbiosi cellulare. Ad esempio è ormai acclarato che i mitocondri delle cellule siano in realtà batteri primordiali che sono entrati nelle cellule umane e quindi hanno anche un DNA diverso, da cui ci sono molti problemi di bioetica, però questo è ormai, diciamo, abbastanza acclarato nella comunità scientifica, per cui c'è una simbiosi fra specie diverse per la sopravvivenza di entrambe. E più in generale la visione, diciamo, scientifica dell'ipotesi Gaia, per cui ci sono delle condizioni necessarie per la presenza della vita sulla Terra. Queste condizioni sono mantenute in un range di valori costanti, tali che se fossero diverse non permetterebbero più la vita, sono mantenute grazie all'attività degli esseri viventi stessi, cioè al metabolismo degli esseri viventi, che influenzano l'ambiente. Quindi non c'è l'individuo in un ambiente in cui si deve adattare, ma c'è l'individuo che adatta l'ambiente in funzione della sopravvivenza della vita stessa sulla Terra. Queste nuove visioni, che suggeriscono una visione non soltanto del male nella natura, possono essere viste dal punto di vista darwiniano, e qui Dawkins lo fa, come dei tentativi di fuggire alla dura realtà della lotta per la sopravvivenza. Però potremmo anche spiegarli in un altro modo, dicendo che la visione darwiniana è una visione storicamente determinata, ad esempio legata ad un modo di vedere della società borghese, per cui ciò che conta è la competizione con gli altri per l'affermazione di sé, mentre guarda caso oggi la metafora dominante di queste nuove visioni scientifiche è quella della rete, che rappresenta anche la maggiore acquisizione tecnologica della nostra società. Per cui, ecco, interpretare storicamente queste visioni scientifiche del mondo. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Again, there are a lot of interesting points. In response to the first clarificatory question, possible world semantics is just a tool in analytic philosophy to understand model claims, so claims about possibility, actuality, contingency, and necessity.
Il mondo analitico, nel mondo della semantica dei mondi possibili, serve per chiarire, per comprendere meglio, per chiarire possibilità, attualità, necessità, questi concetti.
So it doesn't really commit to the idea that these possible worlds actually exist somewhere. So it's just a metaphorical tools to understand these complex model claims.
Okay. Quindi è solamente uno strumento metaforico per comprendere questi complessi sistemi modali. Non è dire che questi mondi esistono realmente.
So by talking about possible worlds, we can eliminate these model notions like possibility, actuality, necessity, and contingency.
We can eliminate.
Yeah.
Quindi parlando di mondi possibili, noi possiamo eliminare questi concetti di possibilità, necessità, contingenza.
So it's just that these counterfactual claims are easier to understand because we can talk about them without talking about modality.
Per esempio, nel caso dei sistemi contraffattuali, di esempi controfattuali, noi possiamo parlare di questi senza dover fare riferimento a modali, a sistemi modali, giusto? È il microfono, scusate.
And your question about what kind of concept of God I assume. I tried to be neutral with respect to a specific concept of God here because my argument doesn't presuppose any specific concept. Okay. So my argument works as long as some form of theism or supernaturalism is correct.
Quindi io non presuppongo nessun tipo di concetto divino, diciamo, a priori, ma nella mia argomentazione può funzionare con diversi tipi di concezione e di approcci di Dio e anche, diciamo,
and I think that's a virtue of my argument because it applies to any theists and any atheists and it doesn't presuppose any specific concepts of God.
Una delle virtù del mio argomento, della mia argomentazione, è che si può applicare a qualunque forma di ateismo e di teismo, quindi a qualunque tipo di concetto di Dio.
And moving on to the second point. So you mentioned that evolution doesn't really presuppose that organisms become better and better and better. And I think you said that because I kind of hinted the idea that the soul-making theodicy could incorporate evolution. But I think that's a good response to this idea. And you are right that evolution doesn't suggest that organisms and animals become better as we go through time.
Quindi sta dicendo che è d'accordo con lei quando sostiene che l'evoluzione non presuppone assolutamente l'idea di un movimento delle creature verso qualcosa di meglio, quindi un, diciamo, proprio un miglioramento a livello di specie, assolutamente. Forse probabilmente lei ha pensato questo perché lui si è riferito alla soul making theodicy, all'idea di incorporare l'evoluzione all'interno del processo di soul making, quindi da questo punto di vista lui è d'accordo con lei.
And in your second point you said that within a theistic framework we cannot make a judgment about whether or not nature is good or
quindi,
bad.
All'interno di una, secondo lei, all'interno di una visione teistica credente, noi non possiamo giudicare teologicamente un evento, le creature, come buone o cattive.
But I'm not really sure about that because theists often say that, you know, this world is very beautiful and amazing and systematic and that suggests the existence of God. So obviously they're making a judgment about whether or not the world is good.
Però non sono sicuro di questo, perché molti credenti molto spesso fanno asserzioni sulla bellezza del mondo, sulla bellezza degli elementi naturali, delle creature, anche quindi su Dio, e quindi in realtà esprimono dei giudizi inevitabilmente sulla creazione.
And going back to your final point. So I think you might be right that my presentation of evolution is quite outdated, and maybe that doesn't really represent the most up-to-date debate in science.
Quindi capisco perché effettivamente la mia presentazione dell'evoluzione è un po' datata e io non ho presentato nessun tipo di aggiornamenti riguardo.
So as you were suggesting, maybe evolution should be understood in terms of cooperation rather than competition.
Quindi tu stai suggerendo che noi dovremmo interpretare l'evoluzione in termini di cooperazione più che in termini di competizione.
But I think my argument still works as long as it's true that our existence is dependent on pain and suffering of many organisms.
Però io penso che il mio ragionamento sia ancora valido nel momento in cui siamo d'accordo sull'idea che la nostra esistenza dipenda comunque da milioni di anni di ma non è sistema.
But even if cooperation is the key in evolution, it still seems that this cooperative system guarantees the existence of pain and suffering.
Quindi anche se il sistema è alla base del sistema c'è la cooperazione, sembra comunque che questa cooperazione alla fine garantisca sofferenza e dolore.
Okay, I think that's all.
C'è una domanda velocissimissima, però velocissimissima.
Yes, it was a very, very brief question. And I was just wondering if the question regarding truth and falsity in religion isn't maybe much more related to our topic than it's apparently seem. And I was just wondering, for example, from a theistic point of view, if we say that something evil or something bad that is happening to me is actually something good because it is wanted by God for a specific reason and so on and so on, are we lying or are we seeing the truth?
So maybe the idea is that there is a second-order truth. So certain things are good or evil on the first level, but on the second level, actually, they are good from a bigger picture.
Quindi ci sono due livelli di... non abbiamo tradotto la sua domanda.
Sì, molto rapidamente. Io riprendevo la questione della verità della religione chiedendomi se non fosse più connessa con il nostro tema di quanto potrebbe sembrare, ma apparentemente, come dicevo, se da un punto di vista religioso, asseriamo che un certo evento apparentemente negativo è in realtà buono perché è voluto da Dio per un fine più alto, stiamo dicendo la verità.
E il professore sostiene che quindi lui dice ci sono quindi due livelli, ci sono il bene e il male e c'è Dio.
So on the first level theists can agree with atheists that there are certain things that are bad or evil.
Okay,
on the first level.
Al primo livello i credenti sono d'accordo con gli atei nel dire che ci sono cose che sono positive e cose che sono negative, però al primo livello, a livello basso.
And I would think that the virtue of a theistic or supernaturalistic viewpoint is that actually they could say that there is a second level. So in a bigger picture, what we considered bad or evil on the first level are not actually bad overall.
Okay. Quindi una delle virtù invece della posizione credente è che può assolutamente giudicare gli eventi del primo livello che sono considerati come buoni o cattivi, in questo caso come cattivi, come assolutamente non negativi, come qualcosa che non è male.
And I think
a secondo livello.
Kind of way of looking at the whole issue seems to be compatible with my approach in this.
Quindi guardando queste due prospettive mi sembrano compatibili con la mia argomentazione.
So you have to be in order to support the basic point. You have to suppose a two-order truth and a dialectic idea of truth.
I guess that's one way of presenting it in a Hegelian way, but I'm not sure if we would have to endorse the whole Hegelian system, but that's an interesting way of presenting the same idea.
if we will die.
Non credente non può dire bene o male, può dire le doppie alternative, l'alternativa di un fenomeno che procede in un modo o procede in un altro. Non può dare un giudizio morale perché è estraneo.
Un non credente.
Un non credente. Okay. È estraneo.
Okay.
Lo giudica, lo vede per quello che è. And fa un'alternativa o un'altra.
Okay. Okay. According to atheistic point of view, atheistic, non theistic, atheistic point of view, a non-believer cannot judge an event as good or evil. He has just two alternatives. But these two options are not good or evil, or one is more good and another is one is worse, another is better. It's not this. A non-believer doesn't make moral judgment about some natural events, because in front of him there are just two options, two possibilities, two alternatives.
I mean, I would think that atheists are naturalists, so they would think that everything takes place as part of nature. So if they said that they cannot make any value judgment about nature, then it looks like they cannot make any value judgment about anything.
Sì,
it seems
in questo modo sembra però che i non credenti siano costretti a non dare nessun tipo di giudizio di valore sulla natura, perché non possono farlo.
So, yeah,
voglio dire che l'uomo è già in trascendenza con il mondo. Ha un fondamento che non può essere detto ateo, si contrappone al teista comunque, per cui essendo calato in una realtà esprime un giudizio di bene e di male, e su questo sono il primo ad ammettere,
okay.
Ma non possiamo prescindere da questo, dobbiamo mettere un presupposto che l'uomo è inserito in una realtà che giudica il bene e il male, comunque non si può estrarre.
Però scusi, allora forse ho capito male io veramente, probabilmente sono troppo raffreddata, non sento bene. Lei all'inizio ha detto che un ateo non può giudicare.
Nel primo livello, secondo
nel primo livello.
Che ho detto nella prima, è non positivo o negativo, il giudizio del mondo.
Nel secondo livello può giudicare.
Secondo livello.
Ok, so at first level an atheist cannot judge as God or evil something. But in the second level, so from a theistic point of view, from punto di vista ateistico, credente, un uomo, a human being can judge an event as good or evil. Quindi può, da un punto di vista ateistico si possono giudicare però gli eventi, da un punto di vista ateistico.
Sì.
Però l'ateo non può. Ok, sorry. Okay.
And is not sufficient to construct this problem? I don't really see why it helps to talk about the second order judgment here.
I
think I don't really get the idea. So is this the idea that natural selection cannot be either good or bad?
Because it's
on the first level.
Yeah.
And on the second level, things can be either good or bad.
Yeah.
And what are on the second level for naturalists?
Naturalists have the second level. So atheist non hanno, gli atei non hanno il secondo livello, rimangono il primo, semplicemente per lei.
Ok,
usciamo
dal... No, anche perché questa domanda è molto interessante, ma riguarderebbe poi la formulazione e la formazione delle idee di bene o di male, cioè se sono idee logiche per cui l'idea di male presuppone il bene, oppure se noi chiamiamo male un'esperienza fisica di sofferenza. Ci sarebbero tutte queste problematiche, ma non c'entriamo, perché altrimenti... bene, direi di fare un applauso finale alle relazioni. Thanks to Professor Nagasawa, to Sofia Vescovelli, to all of you. Ci vediamo alle 15, perché ci sarà una tavola rotonda organizzata in collaborazione con l'Associazione Italiana di Filosofia della Religione. Giù c'è un banchetto con dei volumi, alcuni sono dei relatori di questo convegno, altri sono della casa editrice Centro Studi Campostrini, cioè di questa fondazione. Ve li presenteremo molto brevemente, prima della tavola rotonda ve ne presenteremo solo gli ultimi tre molto brevemente, ma li trovate già per chi volesse giù al banco insieme anche ai libri dei relatori di questo convegno. Alle tre vi aspettiamo tutte per la tavola rotonda su che cos'è questa filosofia della religione che in Italia non sembra trovare un proprio posto ben definito. A dopo, grazie ancora.
Grazie.